All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Dylan Gemelli podcast. And I have my man, highly requested after our first little venture that we did together. And I've got Dave again today for a little bit longer. So my friends, TRT expert and really just expert in general, my man, David Lee.
Thank you so much for having me back once again. It's good to be back with one of the OGs in this space.
Absolutely, brother. And it's just always for me, it's just a pleasure when we get to talk on here or elsewhere, and it's always fun to chat. So I got you for a limited time, so I want to get as much information out of you as I can today. So we're going to cover a lot of things today, everybody. We're going to do a lot of different aspects of TRT. I've had some specific questions come in from people that I wanted Dave to get into, and he's got some new work that he's doing, some attacks on masculinity we're going to talk about, and so we're just going to dig right in. So I had a pretty good question come to me yesterday, and I answered it, but I want some more insight on it because I think a lot of people struggle with this. So I got the question, somebody was taking TRT and they were actually going to the doctor. This is not UGL TRT. So we're talking, we know they're taking real testosterone, but their levels were still in that low 200 to 300 range, even on 200 milligrams per week of testosterone. And they were wanting to know, like, why, like, what is going on? What's wrong with them? What are some factors that make people maybe not metabolize properly, or what are some things to look for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. So firstly, when it comes to testosterone, I like to say that, you know, 8 out of 10 people will respond typically to testosterone. And the other 2 out of 10, I'll say one, you'll get a hyper responder and, like, you know, 70, 80 milligrams a week will blow him through the sky, like double, right, triple, top of the reference range. I'm always jealous of those guys because their TRT treatment involves very small injections that are very cheap. Vial will last them for a year. And the other 1 out of 10 will be a hypo responder, and they will, right, often need 250, 300. I've even got a couple of guys on 350 milligrams per week just to get them above the reference range, like, you know, just scraping the top of the range. And these are healthy guys. These are just guys who genetically are hypo responders, and we don't really know why that is. My theory is that it has something to do with how the specific liver enzymes metabolize cypionate or enanthate. One thing that we don't really know that well, we know that cypionate and enanthate have a very similar half-life, you know, within a few hours of each other. I like to relate them as like Coke and Pepsi. But one thing that we don't really understand is how they are differentially metabolized. And what I have found is that some guys who are low responders to cypionate or enanthate will be better responders to the other. So that could, right, be an option, is that he's not metabolizing one of those esters well. But the best thing to look at for a gentleman in this scenario is to check his LH and FSH levels. Because, mm-hmm, if the LH and FSH haven't become suppressed, it means that he's not responding to the testosterone. And the vast majority of guys respond in some way to injectables. Cream is a little bit more iffy, person to person, or cream to cream formulation. But if his levels are low, he could be a genetic low responder. But the other thing that we have to take into consideration is that the ester of testosterone has to be metabolized in the liver. So anything that impacts, right, liver metabolism is going to mess with how your body metabolizes testosterone. And one thing that often surprises guys who've been on TRT for, like, when they get into like year 2, year 3, year 4, is they go, hey, like, my levels fluctuate by like 20, 30, 40%, even when my injection protocol is the same and I'm measuring it at the same point. And that's because what impacts how the liver metabolizes anything will impact how you metabolize the ester of testosterone. So liver health is a big one, right, as well as if he's a particularly big guy as well. I don't think body mass is a perfect indicator of how much testosterone you need, but it can be a factor too. Bigger guys tend to need more on average, but not as a rule of thumb.
Do you think that perhaps, and I don't think this would have anything drastic to do with it, but do you think perhaps that diet could have anything or play a part in any of that at all? Because that was something I was exploring as well, asking about his diet.
Could be a factor. I mean, he could be eating a lot of certain foods that would impact certain liver enzymes. That could be a factor. It's not something that we see come up a lot, though. Like, and that's, right, one thing that I often note with injections. As I say, look, like 99% of people respond to injections. That's why we, sure, when I say we, I say most people, tend to use injections as a frontline treatment for TRT. It's cypionate or enanthate, because 99%, right, of people respond to it within a pretty decent bracket. So he could be the outlier. I've had a couple of guys who just do not uptake it. And we've been like, oh, it must have been like a bunk batch from the pharmacy, which is like a massive anomaly as well. And, you know, right. the LH and FSH levels don't move and their levels don't go up. And I'm like, are you injecting properly? Like, are you sure right. you're sticking the needle in? Like,
yeah.
But it could be a combination of a couple of factors. Like I had a gentleman recently and we just determined as a hypothesis that he was likely doing his injection sub-Q. And yeah. sub-Q doesn't work for all guys. If it did, we'd all be doing sub-Q, right? So he might have, and we just determined that he was likely a hyper-responder and he was going sub-Q and it wasn't working for him. And, you know, it was like two rare factors that together it's unlikely, but yeah, it does happen. And I think, you know, someone like yourself who's been in this field for a long time, like me, like when you work with thousands of guys, eventually you're going to get that one anomaly.
Yep, exactly. And that's what I kind of said to him too, is like, hey, there's always an exception to every single rule. I don't care what it is. It doesn't matter in life. And I mean, it's like the person that gets struck by lightning or wins the lotto, you know, I mean, it's one in a million. Couple other thoughts I had, I just wanted to run by you. Would any possible thyroid problems have anything to do with that at all in your view? Or do you think that's totally, you know, a different kind of area problem?
If he had like a massive, massive situation of like Graves' disease, it could be possible, but I think he'd sure. have other negative symptoms for that. No, when it comes to exogenous testosterone administration, like thyroid is something that we should always be checking out, especially yeah. if someone is hypergonadal for actually whatever reason, we should always be looking at the thyroid function to see if that's implicated. But mm-hmm. no, I wouldn't say that would be a factor. I'd say that would be separate, worth looking into. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if it was related, he would be having a pretty severe thyroid problem at the time, and that would be a much bigger problem.
Just on a note, I'll just run this by you. I have never in my life had an elevated TSH, right? Like never. And all of a sudden I did. And I just was at a complete loss, you know, just a complete and utter loss. Cause I cut weight fine and everything. And then I've been lacking in my diet with stress. You know, I had been now mm-hmm. way better. And I started taking selenium and iodine and it cut it in half in like a month. I mean, just for people watching, since we brought up thyroid, I just wanted to bring that up and throw that out there. What about this? So I know that generally, and we talked about this a little bit last time about the esters that people were, because we got into the longer esters and how we didn't care for that, you know, and that type of up and down. Somebody like this where the ester could be a problem, do you think switching to propionate or sustanon might be worth a look at all, or...
I think switching to whichever one they're not using out of enanthate or cypionate would be easier. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think propionate is a pain for TRT for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, just less concentrated, so you have to inject more oil. You really, if you're going to be running TRT doses, you really have to do it daily. If you're running bigger doses, I guess you could get away with every other day injections because the trough that you'd be having wouldn't be putting you into hypergonadal territory, but it should yeah. still be done every day, in my opinion. And I guess the problem with propionate as well for TRT is that it's not as forgiving. You know, if you skipped a couple of days of propionate shots, you'd be right down in the gutter.
For sure.
So I think propionate just sucks for TRT in general. For sustanon, I mean, yeah, if sustanon was the only other one that was available, like if he could only get, let's say, enanthate and he wasn't responding to enanthate and sustanon was an option, I don't really have a problem with sustanon. I don't favor it, mainly because it comes in those stupid ampules. It's really common for guys to use sustanon in the UK because it's so cheap. It's like £1 an ampule, whereas like cypionate's like quite expensive. So like if you're getting sustanon for a tenth of the price, I'd be like, and you know, if you're on a budget, it's just like, yeah, you make sustanon work. I think sustanon, you definitely want to pin three times a week if you're doing TRT because a third of it's like short acting. And pinning it three times a week and having it come in a 1 mil vial is not ideal because you kind of have to transfer it into a sterile vial and draw it out. But yeah, that would be another option, is to try sustanon. And it could just be something that he is not metabolizing the ester. And I think that is the most likely thing, aside from like, are you doing your injection properly? And, you know, I've had a couple of guys who I've spoken to who haven't done, actually, they'll probably be watching this, so they'll know who I'm talking about. But they hadn't done injections before in their life, and they didn't realize that when they're using like a half inch insulin syringe, they have to like bury the needle. Like you got to push it in. So they were just kind of like, you know, breaking the skin, dipping it in, doing the injection. And if it's going, you know, sub Q and they're not responding to sub Q and they're a low responder, then yeah, I mean, that could be a factor too. So getting them to show you how they're doing an injection, like I guess one thing that I've learned from just doing a lot of this is I've been surprised at how many guys don't know how to do injections, but I guess it shouldn't be that surprising because it's completely new territory, right? Like if you're coming into TRT and you haven't used anabolics before, you've probably, unless you're diabetic or done peptides, you probably never handled a needle before.
Absolutely. And even some people that do intramuscular, they don't really get into the muscle sometimes, or they kind of half it or don't, or they're not getting in there. And that's a good point. I was so focused on digging up like what could possibly be the problem. I didn't even think about the injection itself. And that's such a good point. I'm glad you brought that up. And if you're watching and you don't know what you're doing, just ask. Just ask somebody or look it up online. I mean, look, if somebody's giving you a hard time because you're asking how to inject, that's not the person to be talking to. I mean, there's no such thing as bad questions with this, even if they're rhetorical, because it's your health. You know what I mean? I mean, if you ask me the sky's blue, I might tell you that's a bad question unless you're colorblind. But with this, it's your health, you know, so ask. I know you'll answer. I'll answer. You know, just ask people.
And the thing that I'm going to chime in there on that topic as well is like for people, if you've never used injections before and you're needle phobic, that's normal. Like you're supposed to be needle phobic if you are not comfortable with it. Like if you're standing there with a needle full of testosterone, your brain has to basically override and go, this is good for you, but you're not going to want to cause pain and, you know, stab yourself in the muscle with something pointy. It's normal not to want to do that. Like I remember my first TRT shot vividly. I remember I was listening to Jay Campbell's audiobook. And I was just basically trying to psych myself up to do this first shot. And to be fair, it was like, it was the needle that came with Primatestin. So it's like an 18 gauge, 1.5 inch. So like, you know, you can see down that thing and I'm sitting there like, it's kind of like the, you know, the Eminem song, like, you know, palms are sweaty. I'm just like shaking, like trembling about to just fucking harpoon this thing into my quad. And so now that we know that we can use insulin syringes, I mean, it's not that bad, but it's very normal to be needle phobic and it's very normal to screw up your first few injections. Like if you do first injection and it's all running down your arm and like you can't quite psych yourself up to stick the needle in all the way, totally fine. You just need to do a few so that you know how it's going to end and you know how it's going to go. And one thing that like I'm almost embarrassed to admit this, but I will admit it here, is I can't explain. I reckon it took me 5 or 6 years to work out that if you're doing a delt injection, if you relax your forearm on the table, it will relax your delt and it will go in so much easier. I had not worked that out.
Game changer. It's totally true. And you know what's funny? I mean, even myself, I had coached people for years before I ever injected or did any, you know, sort of cycle myself. And obviously I'm not needle phobic. I mean, I'm covered in tattoos and I was still, so my boy was with me and he's like, and I'm like, dude, I just don't know. And he's like, stop being a bitch. And that triggered me. I was younger, so I actually cared what somebody said. So I was like, okay, just fucking do it, you know? And then you realize it's no big deal. But to your point, just something that seems so easy about resting your arm, or you have to, if you tighten up or do anything like that, you're going to cause yourself some problems that are easily avoidable. I don't remember if I told you last time or not, but I kept injecting into my delt here and I kept doing it over and over, heavy volume. I'm talking 3 cc's, 4, like stuff you're not supposed to do. And so what happened was I did it over time. I developed this big lump on my arm, was a lipoma, and people would write and say, oh, he's taking Synthol and stuff. And I'm like, you morons, I'm not taking Synthol. I finally had it removed, but I literally, and this is to tell people, if you do that and you keep going same spot and don't rotate, eventually you can cause something like that. I literally had to get surgery. Luckily, I don't really have a scar here because I didn't want to ruin my tattoos, but that's something that can happen too. And when you were talking about the quad, there's very little room for error in the quad. I know it looks huge and it's a big muscle, but man, you can cause some shit. Messing up over there.
People often ask, they go like, for the guys who are still injecting quads, and again, unless you're injecting, you know, unless you're not doing TRT and you're putting in a huge amount of oil, there's no reason to put TRT into your quads. And no. they go, oh, I think I might have hit a nerve. I'm like, bro, if you think you hit a nerve, you did not hit a nerve. If you hit a nerve, you fucking know about it. And I did quads until I hit a nerve. And then I was like, that is not something. It's like playing Minesweeper. There's not that many mines, but if you hit a mine, it's game over.
Oh, dude. I did an injection of heavy amounts of Primo in my quad one time. And, you know, I you know the amount of cardio I do. Well, at the time, I was strictly running every day because I hadn't beaten myself up so bad. And I had a fucking softball on my leg like this. And I was running on it, but I was like, I had tears running down my eyes because that's how bad it hurt. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I haven't gone near my quads in, I'd say, almost 10 years, like literally. I do ventral gluteal. It's so easy, and I just go side to side. But I don't cycle anymore, so you know the injections are. I mean, they're minimal, and I have a phobia. Not that I'm scared. I have a phobia of that that sub Q. I'm not going to get what I need to get out of it, even though I know it's in my head, and I still teach people they can do it. But I'm not comfortable with the sub Q for whatever the reason on myself. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and do you do sub Q yourself, or have you, or what have you done?
I have tried sub Q, and I encourage my clients to all give it a try, because if you're going to be doing this for the rest of your life, you don't want to get 20 years into it and be like, oh, I could have just gone sub Q all along. Sure. Because sub Q is significantly more comfortable. Absolutely. That's the reason to do sub Q. And the more comfortable your injection is, the more often you can inject, and the more stable your testosterone is, the better you're going to feel and the better response you're going to have to your treatment. The reason why I don't go sub Q and why a lot of my guys don't go sub Q is that when I did it, I got about a 40% reduction in serum levels, and I felt significantly worse. And I found that a lot of my guys have had a similar response. So the guys who go sub Q, and we tend to go, look, okay, let's go sub Q for 8 weeks. Let's get a blood test. And if you feel crap before the 8 weeks, and just go back to intramuscular. And if they make it to 8 weeks and their blood work is roughly the same, fantastic. Keep going sub Q. One of the big variables that I've found, so there's a couple of, it's interesting when people argue about this stuff on the internet, and it baffles me that people spend their spare time arguing about this stuff. But for the people who argue about it and go, oh, well, the studies say that sub-Q works, there are two studies on sub-Q testosterone showing that it works just as well as intramuscular. But the most important thing to note is both of those studies were done using grapeseed oil. They didn't do studies measuring different oils, and different oils have different viscosities. So in Australia, we primarily use primatestin, and that stuff is thick. It's thick like goo. I don't know. Actually, no, I know a couple of guys. I'm not going to say I don't know anyone. The vast majority, like 90% plus of guys, cannot do Primo sub-Q because it's too thick. And when you put an injection sub-Q, it has to drain into the lymphatic system. That's how it gets into the body. So when you put like a peptide in water, you put it in sub-Q, it's kind of like draining through tiny little holes, goes in just fine. But the thicker the oil, the worse it's going to work sub-Q. So if you're someone who's like, hey, I want to try doing sub-Q, the best thing you can do is use an MCT-based testosterone to go sub-Q. And the pharmaceutical-based MCT is called Migliol. And the next thinnest oil after Migliol is grapeseed. So those two tend to work better sub-Q. But even so, there's still a decent cohort of guys, including myself, that even using, you know, pharmaceutical MCT oil sub-Q, you get like the lump and it kind of feels like a welt and it's uncomfortable. And it, like, you know, if you're laying on your stomach, like you can feel it, but it also just, it doesn't uptake into the body properly. You don't get the proper serum levels. And then the solution that guys do is, oh, well, I'll just inject more testosterone. I don't know if that's a good idea. Like if you're backing up your lymphatic system like that and it's not getting into the body, like I just look at that and go, nah, just go into the muscle. And like you said, if you're going in ventroglute, particularly if you're using Migliol, I mean, you can generally draw and inject that with a 29 gauge, even a 30 gauge needle. And, you know, 30 gauge into the delt, you know, you bury like an 8 mil 30 gauge, you can get that into the delt for a 0.2 mil injection pretty easy. That's pretty damn crazy.
Yeah, and I was just going to ask you, for the guys that were doing sub-Q injections, what you would tend to draw with needle-wise, just for their own insight and benefit, because I'm sure people that are newer to that will ask.
The biggest needle if I have a guy who's a particularly chunky dude, he'll tend to use a 26 gauge 16 mil needle. But the vast majority of my guys use a 27 gauge half inch insulin syringe to draw and inject their TRT. You just got to be a little bit patient with drawing and injecting it. But if you're using a thinner oil or you're doing more frequent injections, so you've got less volume, like if you're doing like a 0.1 or 0.2 mil injection and you're using something like an MCT, then you can generally use a 29 gauge half inch needle. And if you're doing sub Q and you're using a thin oil, you can often use like a 30 gauge. I don't think a 31 gauge would work. It would be a bit slow, but a 30 gauge 8 mil needle just into the belly fat. Like that's what they use for insulin. Like that's doing one of those every morning if you want to do daily shots. Like I've got quite a few guys who do the daily subcutaneous injection with a 30 gauge because that's just what works well for them. And I think that if you can uptake via sub Q and you're willing to do daily shots, I think that's a fantastic way to do your TRT. So it can be super stable, but you know, you've got to respond to that well. But yeah, the more often you inject and therefore the less oil you're drawing and injecting and the thinner the oil, the smaller the needle you can get away with, which is great.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That's all good information. Cause you know, people that are new, even people that aren't newer to this still, they don't really know, you know, what to use. So I generally, I'm doing intramuscular. I draw with an 18. I've always drawn with an 18. But when you brought up the 18, I got the wide eyes because in actually injecting that, it's like a fucking whale harpoon. I mean, I remember I wasn't paying attention to what I was doing one time and I started to inject with that. And I was like, why won't this go into my skin? And I looked down and I was like, oh, you know, like, what are you doing, dude? You know, it made you kind of jump back. But and for some people, because people ask me, well, do I need a 1.5 inch? You don't need a 1.5 inch. It's too long. There's no reason. You start looking at it and it's looking like, you know, this long. It's too much. And an inch is generally just fine. What do you think about a 1/2 inch? Do you think that's okay intramuscular for some people that are watching?
For TRT, yeah, I think if you're putting in less than 0.5 mil of oil, as long as you like bury the needle, like, you know, you push it all the way in until it's making a dent, that 27 gauge 1/2 inch, like, yeah, it's a little bit slow to draw out, but, you know, you can watch, you know, you can watch a Dylan Jamelli podcast on YouTube while it's drawing.
Exactly.
And yeah, you can draw out and inject, but yeah, I find that, you know, because the delt, like, you know, you shouldn't have much fat on your delt, right? So if you push that needle all the way in, and if you're only injecting, like, you know, a lot of these guys doing TRT, they're only injecting 0.2, 0.3 of a mil at a time.
Exactly.
And the advantage of using those all-in-one insulin syringes is you don't lose any of the oil in the dead space. Because if you're doing 3 injections per week and your testosterone's scheduled and it's, you know, you can't get your next vial until you're about to run out because the government sanctioned it, which is ridiculous, that adds up over time. But it's also just something where we can also measure like 5 milligrams of testosterone. If it's 250 milligrams per mil and you've got an insulin syringe that's marked in increments of 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, those little lines in between are 5 milligram lines. So if we're like titrating someone's dose and they're on like 150 milligrams a week and they're doing 2 injections a week, it means we can move them to like 140 or 160 and we can really fine tune the dose. And I think that's really advantageous when we're dialing in TRT because there's a big difference between like 150 milligrams a week and 200 milligrams per week.
Oh, yeah.
Big difference. So to be able to really fine tune that and, you know, split the injections up and make sure we're really nailing it, I think is fantastic. But the smaller the needle you can inject with, the better. And yeah, if you're injecting only like 0.2, 0.3 of a mil of oil, 1/2 inch into the delt is plenty to be able to get that into the muscle. But if you're injecting like a mil plus, then yeah, you need to go deep.
100%. And that, I love that you brought that up because I get in arguments with people all the time about dosing and I'm more conservative. I'm talking about cycle dosing, but when you're talking about TRT, especially, the difference between 150 to 200 is very significant and people don't, They you know, and I get it because if you just look at the numbers, you're like, that's not a big deal, but it is. It truly, truly is. Let's say for most 5 to 7 times their dose. So if we're looking at 150 to 700, I mean, that's like a difference of possibly 300 to 400 points on your total test level. That's a lot. That because you don't want to be going too high, obviously. So I do want people to really take heed to what Dave just said because it is a big deal. And it's always better to start lower because you can always go higher. You don't want to go too high too fast, you know. And I'm not saying that you don't. There are people that need 200. Like you said, that you've got people that need up to 350. But most don't, you know. So I do want people to think about that, because I'm a more, I've always been, and I've taken a lot of shit because I'm more conservative, but I think about long-term health as opposed to quick fix band-aids, right? You know, mm-hmm. and feeling good for the time being. So, you and I were talking before a little bit about the cream itself, and I've talked about this before, but not in great detail. And so there are a lot of people that don't like injections and don't go to TRT even when they need it because they're worried about injections. And I think we talked about alternative forms a little bit, but we didn't really focus solely on one. So I think cream is probably the most popular aside from injections, or at least the most desirable. Can we kind of get into that a little bit and give me your insight and your experience with it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So I think that, and when I'm talking about cream, I'm talking about compounded cream, not talking right. about the shit that you get over the counter, the 5% cream that's not bioavailable. You have to have a bath in that to make that work. So we're talking about compounded cream, typically talking about 20% compounded cream. But if you're a hyper responder to it, then yeah, 10%, 15% cream, also valid. But typically, I'm talking about a 20% cream. And if it's compounded right, it should be compounded in a liposomal base or an Atrevis base, which makes it more bioavailable. And it's applied to the scrotum. And this is because the skin on the scrotum is thinner, so mm-hmm. it will uptake better into the body. Plus, you're going to have less of risk of a transference. I mean, you can have sexual transference, but unless you're rubbing your ball sack on people, then you're not going to be transferring it, which is ideal. People don't like when you do that, typically. But you know, typically, when people talk about cream or gel, the issue with the cream, well, particularly with the gel, right? I mean, the gel is terrible right. because you have to like slather yourself in goo, and it's like a 1% or like 2% gel.
That's like Androgel, right?
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. you have to cover yourself in this goo, but because you only have so much real estate on your body, like you're going to basically be able to transfer it onto people that you touch, or you know, they often recommend that you put it on like the inside of your elbow and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and,
yep.
I mean, that's just something that, I mean, it's just a hazard for transferring it to people because it can transfer for a couple of hours after you apply it. So putting it on the scrotum means less transference, but more absorbency into the body. Mm-hmm. And the advantage of using the cream, there's a couple. One is, yeah, it's nice not having to inject. And if you've been injecting for ages, not having to inject is pretty nice. Right. I swapped to cream purely out of convenience. When I moved to Europe, it's just a little bit more difficult to get prescribed injections here, and it's a lot easier to get compounded cream. So I just did it out of convenience. And the reason why I like the cream is I personally put it on once a day. And a lot of the time people recommend you put it on twice a day. And mm-hmm. the idea of doing it twice a day is that you get more stable concentrations. That's advantageous. The problem with putting the cream on at night is, you know, you can't transfer it. So, I mean, it kind of makes intimacy quite awkward, which is not ideal, right. especially if you're spiking your testosterone levels. But the other thing in terms of the way that I look at it is that putting it on once in the morning gives you the closest thing that we can do to a natural variation. So yeah, you do get a spike during the day, but it is basically mimicking your natural production more. And I find that having your levels a little bit lower at night not only mimics natural physiology, but it helps with sleep. Having a big testosterone spike right before you go to bed, because that stuff's mainlining into your bloodstream pretty damn quick, that's not going to promote sleep cycles. I mean, it's going to antagonize melatonin receptors, and people often report that it disrupts sleep. But the other thing as well, like if we're talking about injections and we're going, oh, you know, a big spike, that's going to convert a lot to estradiol, that's going to cause side effects, you know, that's going to cause problems. That's why we inject more often, to prevent those big peaks and troughs. But the cream preferentially and significantly converts to DHT compared to estradiol. And that's one of the advantages, is because there's more 5-alpha reductase present in the skin. So when you put testosterone on topically, you get much more conversion to DHT and much less conversion to estradiol. And it's not an issue that I have personally, but this is really advantageous for guys who are starting TRT who are overweight. Because the main side effect that we get when we start TRT on someone who's overweight is too much conversion to estradiol. And, you know, this is what a remedy for that is, you know, more frequent injections, daily tadalafil. Like there's a whole bunch of things that you can do to support that without using aromatase inhibitors. But swapping to cream will allow you to get more of an androgenic pathway with your conversion. So people tend to get less water retention, less side effects, better tolerability, especially for those guys who are needing to get their weight loss, you know, under control and, you know, to kickstart their lifestyle. So for guys who have more of a compromised health profile, the cream can be really beneficial in that regard. But the other time that I like using cream is when guys have got chronic injuries. Yep. Because what happens when you've got a chronic injury is you drive up cortisol, you drive up prolactin. And what these two things do when you drive them up, especially driving up prolactin, a lot of people don't know this, but you know, you can Google it and fact check me, is that high prolactin will downregulate the conversion to DHT. It will inhibit 5-alpha reductase. So yep. Now you're getting a much less androgenic hormone profile conversion, and you're more likely going to get side effects from a potentially intractable chronic injury. So if someone's got something like, you know, herniated discs, or that, you know, they're in chronic inflammation and their prolactin's elevated, their cortisol's elevated, they don't have a prolactinoma, using cream can often lead to much better subjective side effects, much less side effects, and a better subjective outcome. So a lot of the time when I'm working with guys, it's quite common for me to get guys who have chronic pain or they're overweight, and that's some of the reasons why they're hypogonadal. Sure. And they get a much better response to the cream. Otherwise, when they do injections, to be able to tolerate an optimal amount of testosterone, they have to do daily injections. They have to take like tadalafil daily. Like, they've got all these things going on that make it problematic, and the cream can often get rid of a whole bunch of those issues, plus they don't have to stab themselves. So I like the cream. I've just been trialing it just out of convenience. I've had a great response with it, so I'm planning to stay on it for a while. So I think the cream poses a fantastic option for guys who either don't want to inject. And one thing I encourage my guys to do as well, as I was saying before, you're going to be on TRT for the rest of your life. If you want to try cream for 3 months, 6 months, and see how you go, absolutely do it. You can always get your, and this is the way I like to do it, is we know that injections work for the vast majority of people. So right. Get dialed in on injections, get a baseline that you can go, okay, cool, I feel good here, everything's sweet, you know, my dose is X and I can always come back to this, and then trial cream for a few months and see if you like it better. If you like it, stay. If you don't, go back. But I think that that's something that guys should be even encouraged to do by their practitioner, is go, hey, this is going to be a lifelong treatment. There's a few different things we can try to, you know, get this settled in for you. And why not give it a whirl? You might like it better.
Yeah. So what's the trade name for the cream that maybe you're using, or that popular ones that somebody could maybe ask their practitioner about?
So it's compounded. So it would be compounded from a compounding pharmacy. So it's just compounded 20% cream. Typically, okay. It would be a liposomal base. And the trick is, and this is a pain for people in Australia, but it's very common in the US and in Europe, you want to ask for it to come in what's called a Topi Click dispenser, T-O-P-I Click. And I know I can't reach mine, otherwise I'd show it. But basically, it's something where it's, to get the dose, you just basically rotate the bottom and it comes out in a click. So it's very accurate for dosing. But the importance of a Topi Click is that it's dosed in 0.25 mil increments, where a lot of the time the other cream dispensers come in 0.5 mil increments, which is quite a large amount of cream. So it just allows us more ability to adjust the dose and the ability to get an accurate dose every time. And the good thing about the cream is you're putting on the amount of cream that's about the amount of toothpaste you put on your toothbrush. So it's not a lot. So, you know, if you're standing there, you put your cream on your balls, and you know, you brush your teeth for a couple of minutes and then you're done. Pull your pants up, you're good to go. You don't have to stand there for ages waiting for it to dry, awkwardly walk around the house naked. Like, you don't have to do any of that. It absorbs very quickly. So it just becomes part of your morning routine. You know, you wake up, you have a shower, you put your cream on, you brush your teeth, you go about your day. And then you get that daily testosterone spike. It converts more to DHT. Some guys subjectively find that better for them. And then what we do is, what I like to do personally is I like to measure their blood work about 2 to 3 hours after they put the cream on to see where they're peaking. So we typically see a higher level on cream because we're deliberately measuring the peak. And then if we want to be really comprehensive, we also measure the trough right before they put it on. So we can get 2 points of data to go, okay, this is where you're traveling over the course of the day. And what the studies show is that there's about a 50% reduction over 24 hours. So if you're peaking at, you know, 1500 total, at you know, 2 hours afterwards, it means that you're going to be at about 750 the following morning. That's great. That's not like you're crashing down to nothing the following morning. And then you're getting that more natural variation that more mimics natural human physiology as well. So yeah, I'm a fan. The only downside of the cream is that even when you get it made perfectly and you get it liposomal or Atrevis or whatever, some guys just don't absorb it. You put it on, you put a full dose on there and their levels barely move. And if you're in that category, it just means cream's not for you. And that's
right.
tends to be, in my experience, about 10-20% of guys don't respond to the cream.
And that's what I was going to say. I'm sure it's not for everybody. And then you brought up what I was going to ask you about the dosing, because I'm sure people were going to ask how that works. So that's great to know. What when you do just one of those clicks, like you said, and how much? So you said, what was it, 0.2 milliliters? Is that what you said it was about, or 0.28? Is that
0.25 per click? So typically a dose, and this is kind of, I came up with this, and this is just what I've observed in practice. There's a bit of variation, but so if you're doing a 20% cream, right, mm-hmm. and you're doing four clicks, so typically like a higher dose of cream is like four clicks a day, like two in the morning, two at night, or all four in the morning, that's 200 milligrams of topical testosterone that you're putting on. Okay. What I found is that for the average guy, daily topical dose is about equal to weekly injectable dose. So if you're doing 200 milligrams a week of injectable testosterone, a good place to start, a ballpark, and it varies, so we can adjust it, is about 200 milligrams a day of cream. So taking your weekly injectable dose, putting it into daily topical, and then titrating, that's a good ballpark to start if you're transitioning across.
Okay. So generally, you're looking at about 50 milligrams a click.
50 then. Milligrams a click. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Interesting. So weekly to daily. So yeah, you're using a decent amount of that. Is that easily prescribed then for people, or is that something that's a little mm-hmm. bit more difficult to obtain?
It's easily prescribed. A lot of the time, there'll actually be more pharmacies that make cream, because it takes a lot more facilities to compound injectables than compound sure. cream due to sterility. So a lot of the time, the cream's actually more available. It's just finding a practitioner who works with it.
Right. And
one of the things that, I don't know how it works in the States, but one thing that I get guys to do in Australia, if they're trying to find a doctor who'll prescribe it, call a compounding pharmacy and ask them, do you compound testosterone cream? Yes. Do you have any general practitioners on file or clinics on file who prescribe this? They can give you the details. You reverse engineer the process. Asking your doctor about it. But a lot of the big clinics in the States will offer it as an alternative, but it's just about making sure that it's a 20% cream, or, at least 10% in strength, and making sure that it's in a liposomal or a Trevis base, not the, pre-formulated stuff like Andro Forte and all that kind of stuff, because that stuff just doesn't work. It just doesn't get into the bloodstream.
So for people watching, what does liposomal mean?
Liposomal means fat soluble. So mm-hmm. it's just one of their fancy, more modern ways of getting it into the body. It's one of those things that I'm actually not sure how having it liposomal and using it topically works. I assume it just absorbs into the fat of the skin better. Yep. But like, we know that liposomal supplements, like oral liposomal supplements, have higher bioavailability. And that's one of the things we've found that with cream, is that we want to do as much as we can to get that into the body, because it's not easy to, get hormones into the body, like when you just rub it on. That's why we have to do injections. Mm-hmm. So using it, putting it on the scrotum and having it in a liposomal or a Trevis base, that is integral for getting a successful protocol with the cream.
In your opinion, do you think or believe that the cream is the next best option to injections, or what do you feel?
I think that from a practitioner standpoint, injections are a better option, because if you put 100 guys on injections and 100 guys on cream, you're going to get a more consistent response with the injections.
Right.
The other advantage of the injections is that, you have to stab yourself, which is not ideal, but because you're banking half-lives, it's more forgiving. If you've been on TRT for a while and you're doing, Monday shots and Thursday shots, and you go away for the weekend and you forget to take your vial or whatever, if you miss a shot, it's not like you're going to crash down. So because you banked so much in your body. So having that forgiveness with your protocol, if you do it a day early or a day late, it doesn't really matter. You're just splitting up the peak. The downside of the cream is daily adherence. Like if you're only doing your cream once a day and you forget to put it on in the morning, you'll feel it by the evening. Like you don't feel terrible and crap, but like, if you go to the gym in the afternoon and you go, hey, like I'm kind of lagging today, you can feel it. And being tethered to slathering cream on your nuts every day, that's not fantastic. So it's a trade-off, right? It's a trade-off. But I have found that subjectively, some guys do way better on the cream, especially guys who've got issues with not making enough DHT. And that can be from things like, you know, obesity, but it can also be from things like, you know, history of using things like finasteride, using things like SSRIs, chronic injuries. And there's a decent amount of guys that fall into that category who, when they go on TRT, they're always getting these side effects. And then they're taking aromatase inhibitors and they're getting side effects from that. They fix one thing, but they create another problem. So sometimes this could be a good option for troubleshooting. And I guess I get a lot of troubleshooting cases. So
yeah,
I think that cream and injections are equally good, and it would just depend on the guy which one's going to be better. But I will still, for the majority of people, unless there's a big situation going on, start with injections, just because my priority as a health coach, if someone's hypergonadal, is going, let's resolve your low testosterone symptoms ASAP, and then let's look at tweaking it after that.
Okay, so you just brought something up I want to ask you about. Because I get people that just get so, like, there's a few things I talk about that people get so angry at me about and so fired up about. And one of them is finasteride, because I do not, it's funny because two of the things that you and I are going to talk about are finasteride and HCG, two things that I just do not like that people, it's almost like I'm offending them when I say I don't like it. Like they're taking it personal, like they work for the companies that produce them or something. So I want to talk to you about finasteride first, okay? Now, I have made it abundantly clear I'm not a fan. I've done a ton of research on post-finasteride syndrome and have uncovered quite a bit that is troubling. But then there'll be these people that, well, I've taken it for 20 years and, you know, da-da-da-da-da and all of this shit. Okay, great. But let's look at the problems that can occur with it and what people do endure when they have problems with it, because I've seen it wreck a lot of people's lives. I brought up one person in a previous video and the person goes, oh, well, you knew one person. No, I just brought up an example. I know thousands of people through research and people I've encountered. What's your opinions on finasteride? What kind of negative effects can it have on testosterone? And then what kind of negative effects just with DHT, et cetera, do you encounter? And just what's your thoughts and feelings on it?
Yeah, so I will preface that I have some mild personal experience with hair loss for anyone watching the video. I was very attached to my hair when I was younger. As we were talking about before off air, I was in like an emo band. I was a singer. I used to straighten my hair. I used to dye it. I used to have the whole thing going on. My hair was my identity. I was devastated when I lost my hair. I remember looking into it when I was younger. But the other thing I'll preface is that some people on the internet seem to think that there's some kind of like conspiracy that people like me are just trying to make everyone else bald. I will say this, and I will go on record. I do not give a single solitary fuck if an individual takes finasteride. I do not care. If people watch this, I'm like, go and take it. I don't care. But what I do care about is people being able to make informed consent. And I think that that's the most important thing. So if people watch this and they still want to take finasteride, like, it's okay that people on the internet disagree with you. Go take your finasteride, and I wish you all the best with it. But I wouldn't go near it with a 10-foot pole personally. And when people say, what's your opinion and recommendation on it? I think it is one of the worst things you could possibly put into your body.
Agree.
So I did a lecture on, I've got a 3-part lecture series on YouTube called Your Brain on Testosterone and the War on Masculinity. And it goes into how testosterone works in the brain. I care much more about how testosterone impacts the brain than I care about muscle building. That was my background with psychiatry. So there's some people on the internet who seem to believe that DHT doesn't do anything in the body past puberty. That's just asinine. Like, it's just people who read studies who don't know how to read studies. So
true.
Like, for anyone who's ever injected a DHT derivative into their body, we know that DHT does stuff. It does stuff. Yeah. That's ridiculous. So DHT is one of the most important neurosteroids in the body. And what it does in the brain is it increases two things that are really important. Well, three things. One is dopamine signaling, but the other one is norepinephrine, or noradrenaline for the Americans watching. And the other one is GABA. This is kind of like the hormonal version of a Jaeger bomb. It's something that for people who want a relatable analogy. Oh. It's something that's increasing drive, and it's increasing a cool, calm, and collected state as well. That is a very important state to give you the skills to be able to develop leadership and resilience. So DHT is really important for how your conscious experience works as a man, because it's going to give you motivation and drive. It's going to make things that are supposed to feel good, but it's going to give you that buffer against losing your shit and getting overwhelmed. So it gives you drive and momentum forward. It's very good for focus. It's very good for making you feel subjectively better as a man. Very important. The last thing that you want to do is reduce your levels of DHT. You absolutely do not want to do that. DHT is the most powerful androgen in the body. And if when we can recognize all the benefits of testosterone, DHT has those benefits tenfold. So I understand that losing your hair sucks. I understand it full well. I am very happy to go on record and say when I went to the barber and it was looking thin, and like thin hair looks worse than being bald.
Right.
And I remember going to the barber and I was like, is it time? And he took a look and he was like, yeah, it's time. I cried 100%, 100%. I'll admit that. It was horrible. Life has dealt me much more difficult things since then, though. It was, I think that if you have male pattern baldness, going bald is a rite of passage that you'll go through in your 20s. And what it forces you to do is, one, it forces you from an attraction standpoint to work on your physique more. Because when you lose your hair, if you're fat, you look worse because the hair frames your face.
Right.
So it puts more emphasis on your physique. But I think one thing that is a bit of a psyop that men have fallen for is that your value as a man, whether it's to society or to the opposite sex or the same sex, if that's the way that you're inclined, it comes from how pretty you are. And that is not what, one, gives you value, or two, is your primary attraction cue as a man.
Right.
So what gives you value as a man is your capacity, who you are, your values, how you show up, how you treat people, what you do, what skills you have. All of these things are so much more important than your fucking haircut. And there are more things that are important for your physical attraction than how nice your haircut is. Like things like shoulder to waist ratio, body fat percentage, all of these things. So 100. It's a difficult thing to go through, and absolutely. And when I lost my hair, I realized that I didn't actually have a lot to offer beside my haircut. And that was daunting, but it forced me to, and I guess the silver lining, it forced me to develop everything else I needed to do to be able to have value to, you know, the opposite sex. So that was a difficult thing to go through. But at the moment, there is no safe side effect free way to keep your hair. Either it doesn't work and it's safe, or it is dangerous and it does work. Now, I got scalp micropigmentation, so mine's faded a bit, but I've got that tattooed on to make it look like I've shaved my head voluntarily. That helped a lot when I went through that transition. And for anyone who's going to do that, you know, I'm sure you'll attest to this as well. If you're going to get tattooed, make sure you get a good tattoo artist, especially if you're getting tattooed on your head. Don't get one of those square, sharp hairlines. If you don't have a hairline like that, it looks way worse. So get a good person who's going to do it. But finasteride is something that there's some people who are in denial that post-finasteride syndrome doesn't exist. You can go online and you can find that there was a class action against the company who made finasteride, where a whole bunch of people who had PFS got together and they sued them, and the company that made finasteride lost. But the most important part was they admitted on stand that they were completely aware of post-finasteride syndrome. They were aware of permanent side effects after discontinuing the medication, and they went on record to say that they didn't disclose that because it would impact the sale of the drug. The thing that was fucked up about this is that when they lost, all they had to do was change the package insert to say side effects will resolve to side effects may resolve. That's all they had to do. There was a movement to take it off the shelves a couple of years ago because of the issues with it causing people to commit suicide.
Yeah.
And if people are still in denial that post-finasteride syndrome doesn't exist, if the company who made it admitted that it's real, like I don't know what more evidence people want, but if people are going to continue taking it, knowing all that, and they want to roll the dice, cool. But understand this, you may not think you have side effects now, but firstly, you don't actually get to experience a parallel timeline version of you who's not taking it. So you don't really know. But secondly, my main concern with finasteride is that it's going to lead to early onset dementia, because you're blocking DHT, but you're also blocking allopregnanolone. And these things are very important for maintaining the structural integrity and the antioxidant capacities in the brain. So if keeping your pretty haircut is worth potentially having early onset dementia and you want to make that trade, I think you should speak to a therapist. That's my personal opinion.
I agree.
Is that if people are aware of all this stuff and they still want to take it, I don't think that's something that should be entertained. I think that that's something that people need to speak to a therapist about, self-esteem and seeking external validation. Because I think that if you're aware of this stuff and you still choose to do it, then that means that there's something going on that needs to be worked through and resolved, not enabled. But that's just my personal opinion.
I am so glad we brought this up and you ever mentioned Finastra, because this wasn't on my list of things to even discuss. And now I feel bad because I normally wear a hat and I just got my hair cut so we could have a nice, you know, nice look today and more clean. So now you made me feel bad. I'm just blessed with good Italian genetics, man.
You've got some thick hair there. Like, you're doing very well.
I appreciate it. And you know what's funny? You brought up the DHTs, which we know are the ones that'll knock your hair down the most. And those are the ones that I use the most. And I'm just extremely, thankfully, blessed. I don't use anything anymore. But that was just to prove your point. I mean, my best results have always been on DHTs with Anavar and Primabol. And now, granted, you're not going to bulk with these, like, unless it's Anadrol, for instance. But anyway, to your point on the PFS, especially, there's really not a cure for it, or sort of, like, I've had people tell me they've used Proviron and it's actually helped them, but I've seen people that develop like brain fog, like excessive water retention, like bad memories, depression, like you were saying, people that were killing themselves and things like that. Is it going to affect every single person? Are that every single person going to get PFS? No, but the chances, the longer you use it, and then once you stop taking it, because you're going to eventually want to stop. This is not something you should take forever, even though some people have. That's when it can be even the real problems can set in. And I don't think people realize this or understand this. Just like you said, I'm not going to lose sleep if you fucking use it or not. I'm not going to wake up in the morning and go, oh, so-and-so messaged me on YouTube and called me an asshole. And, you know, da-da-da. I don't give a shit either. But I do care about educating people, like you said, you know, so that you are aware and you understand. I don't work for some kind of competitor or the FDA or whatever. I don't work for anybody that has anything to do with this shit. But just like you said, I don't know of a 100% safe way when it comes to hair. I think there's some better options than Finasteride, but I still wouldn't recommend them. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those things, like you said, I used to be very vain. I was a model. I get it. Like, I was too. And I would be the same way with my hair. But what you offer is far more than the hair. And I guess you've got to weigh the risk versus reward. Is it worth it to you to possibly like ruin your entire quality life long-term and take that risk, or develop a look? Because the first time I saw you, and I hate to say that impressions on how people look, I was like, I told my wife, I bet you anything he's smarter than shit, just the way you look. You know, even though you were like the one with the leather coat but I looked at you and I was like, I just have a feeling this fucking guy is really smart. And I was like, see, I told you, I know. But it's, you develop your own look, how you look. I don't give a shit if you got hair or not. I care about who you are, you know, and what kind of heart you got and what kind of person you are. So every point you brought up was tremendous. And I really appreciate the insight on that. That's coming from somebody that actually gets it and cares. So yeah. Thank you for that. And I feel a little validated too, I'm not going to lie, but
it's an important thing for people to look at. And when we look at the side effect rate in the finasteride studies, it's anywhere from like 1% to like 14% in some studies. So
yeah.
I like to put it like this. If we're talking Russian roulette here, because that's the other thing with finasteride, like PFS, is that like, I don't know how to fix it. No one knows how to fix it. That one of the best things that you can do if it is intractable is going on, you know, testosterone cream and potentially using things like pregnenolone or DHEA if those things get impacted as well. But like, it's not a perfect fix. And that's not a, you know, oh, just take this and it's fixed. I mean, that's a treatment for the rest of your life. That's an imperfect cure.
Right.
We don't know how this impacts things like epigenetics for fertility. We don't know how this is going to impact people's kids in the future. I mean, there's so many things, but the simple way that I would put it is go, okay, let's put a really low estimate on the side effects and say it's 1 in 20. Would you play Russian roulette with a 20 barrel chamber with one bullet in it to keep your hair? Fuck no. Because if you get hit with that one bullet, it's not worth it, because the hair, it's not essential. It doesn't do anything other than for aesthetics. And my opinion, and again, people will say I'm just trying to cope, but I'm the one who's not insecure about being bald, so it's not a cope. It's just the reality of it. I've gotten over it. Is that when we look at, you know, if you go into those bullshit, you know, most attractive people of the year that those Time magazine Hollywood celebrity things do,
yeah,
there's always bald dudes who are some of the most attractive dudes, like that Jason Statham guy, Dwayne Johnson, like all these guys. But when you look at men who are deemed attractive who are bald, they're men who also have androgenic traits. And this is the thing that I tell guys who are going on TRT who are worried they're going to lose their hair, is that when you go on testosterone for a period of years, it androgenizes your facial features and your physique. And that means that if you are going to go bald, you're going to suit it more than if you had low testosterone. So
right.
If you can fill out your shoulders and have your facial physiques androgenized, if you are genetically predisposed to going bald and you have male pattern baldness, as long as you are in shape, you will to some degree suit it. And that's just, it can be a difficult pill to swallow. It can be, it sucks. It's a difficult thing to go through. But when there's not really a safe alternative that you can choose from, it's like, well, that's life. And there are so many more difficult things that are going to come up. Like, I get that it's tricky because it happens when you're usually in your 20s or your early 30s and you're still forming your identity and maybe your confidence is low and you haven't built a bunch of skills and you haven't, you know, got all these. Like, if male pattern baldness happened at like 50 years old, it would be way less of a big deal. But when it's happening when you're young and when you're impressionable and when you're insecure and you might not have a lot going for you, like, I get it. It's a difficult thing to deal with. But not as difficult as PFS. It's just not worth it.
No, it's not. And to your point, when I was modeling in Milan and I went to an audition and it was at Dolce & Gabbana, and I got there and I waited in my line like an hour that I did. I got up there and they said, "We're only looking for people that are bald right now. Sorry." And I, okay, goodbye. And I had to just leave after sitting there. And I mean, it's a look that is prevalent in a lot of areas, and it doesn't, you know, I mean, it's how you roll with it and how you rock it. And you can really rock anything, you know, in life. You just play the cards you're dealt and make it work. So all right, so that was my first friend that we wanted to talk about, and I say that sarcastically. Here's my ultra best friend. Okay. And so people that are watching me know, and you already know, I want to talk about HCG. I once again, now, okay, I'll have people that say, and this has been at least 10 years. I worked for a company that was selling a testosterone booster, and they would say, oh, you can use it in place of HCG. I fell for that shit when I worked there, and I made it very clear after that, look, this does not replace HCG, okay? I did that. I was naive, and I was doing the company thing, and I made it very clear. No, a testosterone booster does not replace HCG, no matter how hard you say it does or whatever. But I still fucking hate HCG. I don't find that it has much of a place anywhere. Like I talked to you about it before, in a certain fertility protocol, I find the merit. I do, but it's not the main component. HMG is the main component. And I've seen this done on so many people and I've seen it work, but without HMG, you're spinning your wheels. It's just a proponent of it. Now, this is what I observe here with doctors and especially TRT clinics, and we know not every TRT clinic's bad. I work for one, like as an ambassador, but most of them, you go in there, and especially the ones that want to get you on monthly shit, they're going to put you on your test, your HCG, and anastrozole. That's just what they're doing, and I find it kind of shitty because I don't see the reasoning other than getting your ball size bigger. And really, 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 who gives a fuck? Okay. But I want the scientific aspect of this from you, as opposed to people that get mad at me. What's your feeling on HCG? Do you find it necessary? And if not, please explain why it's not necessary so that I'm not such a dick.
Absolutely. So for anyone who wants a more in-depth and maybe less vulgar version of this, I've written a book on this and I've done a lecture on this. So the lecture is free on YouTube. You can search Beyond TRT Part 2. It was a webinar for Marek Health that we've uploaded. So that's on HCG, estrogen, and fertility, which is like the three most contentious topics. And there's also a book on my website called Beyond TRT, which covers the same thing. There's nothing in the book that you have to pay for that you're not going to get for the free lecture. So watch the lecture. My thoughts on HCG. Firstly, HCG is a female pregnancy hormone that has no place in male biology.
Thank you.
The only reason that we use it is because we can't, for some reason, use bioidentical luteinizing hormone. That's the only reason that HCG exists. Now, HCG has been studied in men to basically, we found out that it activates the Leydig cells. So that's why it makes your testicles bigger, and it spills over into FSH, which is why people use it for fertility. We don't know what else it does in men. We have absolutely no idea what happens when a man is walking around for the rest of his life who can piss positive on a pregnancy test. Now, maybe I'm old fashioned and it's 2024. So people think all kinds of crazy shit these days about gender. But I don't think it is pragmatically healthy when we don't know, and I think it should be guilty until proven innocent, for a man to have a physiological level of a first trimester pregnant woman of HCG, because we don't know what it does. Secondly, every study on testosterone ever has been done without HCG. So every study that looks at the benefit of TRT has not used HCG. So anyone who's saying that HCG needs to be used with TRT is not practicing evidence-based medicine. It is bro science. Thirdly, man, this might go for a while. I do not know anyone who says that HCG is mandatory for TRT who doesn't sell HCG. Everyone who is financially independent tends to have a more balanced view. I think that's important. Always follow the money. The things that are bullshit are the things that people who only sell it promote. So if there's no one impartial promoting it, it's bullshit. And then going from there, the main reason why HCG is problematic is that a decent chunk of guys, I would say 30 to 50% of guys, get negative side effects from it. That's probably the most important part.
Yes.
Now, there is a myth that has circulated the internet for a long time, and I have done so many lectures on YouTube on this, written the book on it. I have campaigned this for a while, that when you go on TRT, it shuts down the upstream hormones, pregnenolone, DHEA, etc. Firstly, that's not true. If you actually do this for work and you look at blood tests all day, every day of guys on TRT, there is not a widespread pregnenolone and DHEA deficiency of guys on testosterone monotherapy. That is just not the case. Now, if you have abused anabolic steroids in the past, if you are elderly, you know, past like 50 or 60 years old, you could have issues with pregnenolone and DHEA, but HCG doesn't restore those levels. So it's all this hypothesis based on the fact that there is, again, one of the biggest, and I don't mean to sound elitist because I studied science at university. You don't have to study science to be able to interpret literature, but you have to learn how to interpret studies. So if you haven't learned how to read literature, then you should learn how to read literature before you argue about literature on the internet. But again, I don't read the comments. I don't care. The issue is that there are studies that show that when you put testosterone into the body, it shuts down pregnenolone and DHEA in the testicles, not systemically. It either does it in the testicles or it does it in the ovarian cells. This is what's been studied. Now, if we are fulfilling the end role of testicular function by putting testosterone in, that makes sense. That's part of the body having a negative feedback loop. And then people will say, oh, well, luteinizing hormone is essential for the conversion of cholesterol to pregnenolone. No, it's not. It is in the testicles, but not in the adrenal cells. ACTH is actually the primary driver for conversion of cholesterol to pregnenolone systemically in the body. So not only is it mechanistically untrue, but in practice, it just doesn't happen. If anything, there's actually studies that show that when you put testosterone monotherapy into a man, DHEA goes up, not down. So I find it actually doesn't move. So there's all these misconceptions that people parrot and then they just become myths. Like it's just bro science gets repeated and it becomes myths. And the idea that it's essential is ruled out. Now, the idea of could it be beneficial, different story. I don't think it's a good idea to put female pregnancy hormone into a male body. And this is like the million-dollar question that it all boils down to. And I think that it's okay to be able to go, I don't know, but this is how I feel. Because people who try to say they know everything about everything is nonsense. This is an evolving field. So is it better to stimulate the Leydig cells? Because we know that there are Leydig cells systemically in the body. They're not just in the testicles. And we don't fully understand what they do. So is it better to stimulate them with a female pregnancy hormone? Or is it better to leave them dormant? either of those are not ideal, but I think we have to make a choice and go, okay, which one should we do? And given that we have a huge amount of literature on testosterone monotherapy, and we have no literature and no understanding of what's going to happen to all these guys who are taking HCG long-term, and it causes a decent amount of guys' side effects, I'm going to lean on this side of the equation. So the last thing that it comes down to is fertility. And when it comes to fertility protocols, the benefit of HCG is that it spills over into FSH. So it's primarily agonizing the luteinizing hormone receptors, but it has some spillover. So if you take a shit ton of HCG, like 1,500 units three times a week or more, some studies are like 5,000 units three times a week, you'll stimulate the FSH receptor. Now, what is that doing to the epigenetics of your baby if dad is walking around with first trimester pregnancy levels of HCG? I don't know, but I'm glad that my dad didn't do that when he was when he impregnated my mom. Because we have no idea what this is going to do to the epigenetics of the kid. Plus, I don't personally use HMG because it's not available in Australia. I use FSH. And we can literally get the bioidentical thing, like the thing that we're trying to stimulate. We have that available. So when it comes to a fertility protocol, I only put HCG in a fertility protocol at the maximal dose that stimulates the Leydig cells, which is 250 units a day, with FSH at 150 units three times a week. That's the study dose of, because we're going, okay, we've taken care of the FSH receptors because that's the study dose for that. And then we're using the dose that maximally stimulates Leydig cells, but we're only using the HCG because we can't get luteinizing hormone. We're just using it in its place. And that's just for a short period to make fertility happen so that you don't have to come off TRT and go hypergonadal to conceive.
Yeah.
That to me is the only application of it. And what I think, like one thing that we know that's a difference with HCG versus luteinizing hormone, because if HCG and luteinizing hormone were the same thing, women would just make more luteinizing hormone when they get pregnant. They are physiologically different. And one thing that it does is it stimulates cyclic AMP like eightfold higher. So it's stimulating. You know, that's the theory behind the bullshit HCG diet. So I think that a lot of the time guys who benefit from HCG and they subjectively like how HCG makes them feel is that they are band-aiding issues with their metabolism. And they could also be, because we also know that when you put luteinizing hormone into the body, it can actually stimulate erections as well. So I also think that guys who have issues with sexual performance, whether it's sexual anxiety or they're unhealthy and that's impacting their sexual function, I think HCG is band-aiding that. So when guys go, oh, I need HCG to have good libido, I need HCG to have good erections, it's like, well, maybe you're band-aiding something that's off because, again, this is just my opinion, you shouldn't need a female pregnancy hormone to have good sexual function and erections, because we've got all this literature on testosterone without HCG that shows that it doesn't cause sexual problems. It actually causes sexual benefits.
I love it. I am so glad that you just ripped all of that off because it was just enlightening. And I don't know how much better that could be broken down. I always stress to people too, HCG, it does increase your estrogen. It is suppressive, and I get these guys that want to argue me, and this is off the topic of TRT, but these guys that want to tell me that it is the gold standard in PCT, where I argue it is literally the worst thing that you could ever do in PCT, because you're mimicking the luteinizing hormone, which you're trying to stimulate during PCT. What happens when you use exogenous testosterone? You're mimicking testosterone, then your body forgets to produce it, right? So what the hell is going to happen if you're doing the same thing with your luteinizing hormone? Would it not be the same where you're mimicking it and then it's going to stop producing it? That's why I would argue that if you are intent on using it, go ahead and do that before PCT, but not during PCT, which just to me is the most senseless and bro scientific thing that I've ever heard. But people will argue tooth and nail with you about it. And I'm just like, fuck it. Go do it. Have at it. And then don't come to me and bitch and complain after I told you not to do it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you this. What are some of the side effects that you see aside from what I just brought up, especially people that do it longer term, are some of the things that you've ran into that people encounter when using it?
Yeah, cool. Okay. Yeah. There's definitely some stuff to go into there. So firstly, it seems to me that HCG is inherently feminizing. This just makes sense. And one thing that, like, I don't advocate for the use of aromatase inhibitors, but one thing that I have noticed is, and maybe you can comment on this, is that guys will take HCG, they will get what they would call estrogenic side effects, feminizing side effects, that don't resolve when they take an AI. And then people go, oh, it's because HCG is increasing intratesticular aromatization and the AI can't touch that. Bro science crap. Like, that's, it's a theory, but I think it's nonsense, because I think that HCG crosses the blood-brain barrier and it has inherently feminizing effects.
Yes.
Because I have felt higher estrogen levels and I have felt HCG and they are different. And I also don't think that there's any research to suggest that anastrozole doesn't impact intratesticular aromatization. Why would it not? Why would the testicles have some kind of bulletproof anastrozole vest around them, but every other tissue in the body is impacted? Just nonsense. So I think that one thing in the literature that HCG does in women, which is where it's been studied, because again, we just don't know what it's doing to men, is it has progesteronergic, I don't know what the word is, it increases progesterone. And progesterone, when it's at a supraphysiological level in a male, is anti-androgenic. It reduces 5-alpha reductase, and it blocks the androgen receptor as well. So I think that it has inherent feminizing properties in and of itself. And the thing that guys always note when they take it and they react, if they react badly to it, which is not everyone, but the guys who react badly to it, they say that it makes them feel how they felt before they went on TRT. Yeah. And the big thing that guys note is it makes them anxious. And I think that evolutionarily, HCG has a role for women in making them hypervigilant, because it's from an evolutionary perspective, it's very important that pregnant women survive. So right. I think that that hypervigilance, the increase in cyclic AMP, the inherent feminizing effects, I think that these are all important for female survival during pregnancy. And mm-hmm. I think that that has a role in terms of what side effects it causes. Now, I'm not like a steroid cycle guy or like a PCT guy, but I've looked at PCTs mechanistically. And to me, HCG's role in a PCT seems to be basically band-aiding the period while the ester works its way out of the body. Because if you've banked like 12 weeks of cycle and, you know, you're doing 500 milligrams of test a week or whatever, and you stop doing your injections, it's going to take a while for that ester to clear the body. So people put the HCG in to basically band-aid the crash, but it's not helping your body restart natural production. That's what the Clomid or tamoxifen is for. So you're actually just suppressing your production more. And my logic for that is, well, don't use a female pregnancy hormone to use that. Just swap to propionate at the end of your cycle. And that way, when you stop doing your pins, it'll clear out quicker. So you can use propionate while the cypionate or enanthate is working its way out. So you swap over for the last few weeks of your cycle. But it's not helping you restart your production at all. It's suppressing you just as much as the androgens. It's the tamoxifen or the clomiphene that's actually supporting the body coming back. And even that's just band-aiding the system anyway. I mean, we don't really know that well how those things work. But yeah, I don't think HCG has a place in PCT either. But if you were only going to use either, I prefer tamoxifen over Clomid, but if you were only going to use a SERM or HCG for a PCT, it's not a competition. It's the SERM. Like HCG is like a bro science add-on to it, but I don't think it's helping anything. So yeah, the main side effects are estrogenic, and yeah, I think it is inherently estrogenic, and I think it crosses the blood-brain barrier. But again, I've got a full lecture on this on YouTube. It's about a 20-minute segment. There's slides and shit, and people can watch it. But that's basically my breakdown of it. And the perspective of it is that, like, the other thing that I'll throw in as well is that there are people at the moment who are saying that you should run HCG with your TRT for fertility. And if that was the case, we wouldn't need FSH.
Exactly.
But exactly. The other thing as well is that TRT doesn't make everyone infertile. If it did, we'd use it as contraceptive. Right. But the thing that I have noted, and I'm very conservative, so like it sounds reckless, but this is just what I've noted in practice. And again, talk to your doctor. I'm not a doctor, blah, blah, blah. But of all the times that I've run these fertility protocols that I spoke about before, the use of HCG prior to that has had nothing to do with whether the protocol worked or not. So right. if you're like, I want to have a kid in 10 years time and I'm currently, you know, infertile from being on TRT. If you think that running HCG in the background is going to make a difference when you actually do the fertility protocol down the line.
Right.
I get the thinking, because you're like, oh, I'm keeping the testicle stimulated. It's an insurance policy, blah, blah, blah. I get that. From like a pragmatic mechanistic theory perspective, makes sense. In practice, it doesn't seem to matter. It doesn't. No. It really doesn't.
No, I agree 100%. And just to touch on a few of the things you said. So one of the reasons that people will say, well, a lot of them are HCG users during PCT. Well, there's no reason to even use PCT because I lose all of my gains. Well, the reason you're losing gains is you're not recovering properly, because you're suppressing yourself further. And then your recovery is being elongated. It's just being prolonged. You're just delaying it is all you're doing by using HCG and PCT. Also, being that it's so estrogenic, the last thing that you want to do in PCT is increase estrogen. I can't think of anything worse. Mm-hmm. Now, another thing that you brought up a lot of time is an aromatase inhibitor will not counteract the HCG use for some reason. And that's why some people will tend to have to go. It's kind of like with Anadrol, where you're getting estrogenic side effects, but it's not converting to estrogen. So you have to go with an estrogen blocker as opposed to an aromatase inhibitor. So you would look at Clomid, Novadex, or possibly Raloxifene. I'm not a big fan of Raloxifene, but that's another story for another day. But every single point that you brought up is so valid, and I haven't touched on everything you brought up. You are more well-versed on HCG than me, and perhaps in the past I've gotten a little too angry, and that's on me. That's my fault, because I get a little pumped up about it, you know, and it pisses me off. But the misuse of it, I find, aside from just flat-out steroid abuse, I think that that is one of the most misused, misunderstood, and misguided, I call it an ancillary, out there that you could possibly even use. And it is troubling, and I don't think people know exactly what it is. That's why I'm not a fan of using Clomid or Novadex too much either. You're talking about something that treats breast cancer or something that treats female fertility. I can't justify using these unless they're just absolutely necessary. You know what I mean? It just doesn't make a lot of sense. Fucking testosterone is different. That's something that men need. But when we're talking about, like, people, for instance, that want to use enclomiphene or Clomid or for their TRT therapy, I'm just saying that is not ideal. And I don't know what that's going to do to you long term. It's not meant for that particular use. Mm-hmm. Right. So what do you think about, like, substituting Clomid, or now it seems enclomiphene is just taking over this craze about people wanting to use it for TRT. And what do you feel about substituting those instead of actual testosterone?
I don't understand why people are so desperate to not use testosterone in order to increase testosterone. Like, I get not wanting to go on TRT if you can optimize your levels naturally. I am all for that, 100%.
Yeah, me too.
But in what world is using a... I mean, they barely even, well, they kind of do, but they barely even use them in breast cancer anymore because they're so toxic. Like, why would you want to use a toxic repurposed breast cancer medication rather than bioidentical testosterone when the goal is to increase testosterone? That's number one from a logical standpoint. Secondly, they cause non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So that's there also why that you don't use them. Like, I'm a bit of a NAFLD specialist as a health coach. But yeah, happens all the time. The idea, like, someone could, and it, again, mechanistic theory going, okay, well, what if we just used a little bit of tamoxifen to block the estrogen receptors in the hypothalamus so that while we're on TRT, we can have natural luteinizing hormone production? That sounds like a great idea. The problem is that, one, we don't know the neurotoxic effects of doing that. We're just going, okay, we're going to mess with a whole bunch of shit in the body. We're going to put this drug in that acts as a estrogen antagonist some places and a non-bioidentical estrogen agonist in other places. We're going to fuck with estrogen signaling all over the body just to do this one thing, and we're just going to throw caution to the wind with everything else that's going to happen, which, again, hasn't been studied. We have no idea.
Right.
One, terrible idea. Two, if it worked, we'd all be doing it, and we're not, for a reason. It's not like we just haven't thought of it. We have, and people have tried it, and it didn't work out for them. But the problem with the enclomiphene, like, yeah, I get why enclomiphene is trendy, because people want to have their cake and eat it too. Like, they want to not go on TRT, but they want to have the effects of TRT.
Sure.
The problem with the enclomiphene thing is that it might boost your levels on paper, but people still feel like shit because of all the other crap that enclomiphene's doing in the body.
Right.
People think that the side effects of Clomid are from the, like, because Clomid makes people want to kill themselves. Like, Clomid makes people feel like shit.
Yes.
And people go, oh, well, because we've removed the zooclomiphene, which is the estrogen agonist side of it, and we're just using it, the estrogen blocker, that's going to avoid that issue. What makes people think that it's the zooclomiphene that's causing the problem? It could just as likely be the enclomiphene causing the issue. And when I see the side effects, it doesn't sound like estrogen overload to me in terms of what this is doing to people's mood. But again, these drugs have not been studied long term.
Thank you.
I have no idea how in the States they're even being prescribed. It must be some bullshit loophole. But there's no long-term human studies on enclomiphene, so it shouldn't be being prescribed by medical practitioners. And anyone who's prescribing it is not practicing evidence-based medicine. Like, we don't have the human trials to support its use. So if people want to guinea pig that, go for your life. Like, don't let me stop you if you want to do that. But from like an educational standpoint, it's going, well, if you are hypergonadal, meaning that you cannot restore your nap, because the thing is that you should try to not go on TRT. Like, if you have low testosterone, you should try to recover those levels naturally. If you can't optimize those levels naturally, because like, you have to do all that shit anyway if you go on TRT. So you're gonna have to sort your shit out anyway. But if you're doing everything right and your testosterone levels suck, you need TRT. Like, Clomid's not going to work. Like, it might bring your levels up. It's gonna make you feel like crap. It's gonna cause side effects. But I have never, and I will go on record saying this, I have never, and all my colleagues who I work with, which together, that is tens of thousands of TRT patients and clients all over the world, I have not met one person who has stayed on Clomid or enclomiphene therapy in place of TRT. I have met so many people who've tried it and they go, yeah, my numbers increased, but I didn't feel any better, or my numbers increased and I feel worse. I know no one who has stayed on it. None.
So, great points and things that I argue quite a lot when people bring this up. On the enclomiphene, that one's not really, it's not that it's being prescribed. It's that people are going to UGLs or they're going to research companies, and that's where they're getting that. That's not, and just like you said, look, I'm not going to sit here and say enclomiphene doesn't work in PCT, because I've seen it work in PCT. Yeah. But we're talking, so just for people that want to just immediately listen to the whole thing in the context. We're talking long-term use and we're talking in place of TRT. Mm. There is not nearly enough study for that. And just like you brought up, and the way that it makes you feel, and we don't know what aspect of it was actually causing the problems. Now, the Clomid, like you said, and I find this more because I don't even know where to start with this, but people will want to use 200 and 300 milligrams a day of it to start when they use it. 50 milligrams is a lot.
Clomid.
Yeah. Oh, I don't even. So a lot of times people have, and this was, it seems like this has died down a little bit once we blasted this information out that, oh, we need to load Clomid for a week or, you know, whatever beforehand. No, you do not. Mm-hmm. Even 25 milligrams of Clomid is a lot.
20.
You start doing 200 milligrams of Clomid, several things are going to happen. One, you're probably going to start seeing those floaties in your eyes and think you're going, like, having vision issues. Secondly, you're going to get into this, like, overly emotional, likely depressed, and like you said, even on the tiff of suicidal thoughts. So it'll play with you emotionally to the point where you're just like a total disaster and a mess. And thirdly, using it long-term and in place of testosterone to me makes absolutely zero sense whatsoever. It is not the same thing as exogenous testosterone. It's not even close. Basically, it's a Kickstarter to get your LH and FSH going, and the long-term use can be just extremely detrimental, as you pointed out. I've seen some doctors that have actually put people on this and kept them on it. I don't know their level of expertise or how qualified they are, but I have seen it because I've seen people come on the forums and tell me about it, unless they're just lying and doing it themselves, which I can't personally prove. I don't know any doctor that's ever that, and I've talked to fucking many doctors that ever recommend that at all, but it's not something that I would, I mean, if you paid me to go tell people to do it, I'd tell you to fuck off. I don't want your money.
you know, because I know it's not ideal or worth it at all. There's nothing that's going to take the place of testosterone for TRT, period. End of story. Don't you agree?
If someone needs an intervention for hypogonadism, I don't understand why you wouldn't use the bioidentical thing that you need. Like, that's the best possible thing. Why would you use some dirty, unstudied drug to increase that thing when you could just use the bioidentical thing? Like, that's it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I understand why it would be appealing to people who kind of want to boost their levels when they're not low and so forth. But again, if it did work, we'd all be doing it, and it doesn't. And using like hundreds of milligrams of Clomid, that I've never heard of that. That's insane. Like, even 20 milligrams of tamoxifen, as long as it's pharma grade, that'll put your LH and FSH up into the top half of the range. Like, you don't need any more than that. And I assume the equivalent of Clomid would be like 50. I've seen a couple of guys come to me in the past who were taking like 40 milligrams of tamoxifen and 100 milligrams of Clomid. And I was like, that's just so overkill. And they felt like dog shit. And that's going to do, that would do more damage than the whole fucking cycle. That's the thing that I think is wild. And guys really need to start taking their health more seriously, because you don't get problems until you do. And hindsight's 20/20. So you don't want to get down the line and be like, oh, I have permanently ruined my body, I only get one, for the sake of being an idiot. It's just not worth it. And yeah, this is one of the reasons why I put so much educational content online, is that, like, there are so many people out there, whether they are, you know, coaches or even doctors, who are just practicing this in a way that is horrendously uninformed and legitimately doing harm to people. And it's just not necessary. So yeah, if you need an intervention for hypogonadism, that it means you're going to be dependent on one thing for the rest of your life. So why would you want to be dependent on Clomid over bioidentical testosterone? Doesn't make any sense.
I wish I had an answer for that, brother. I just don't. So I know that you probably have to go at this point, because I could keep going on and on and on. But this, once again, I learn a lot every single time I talk to you, no matter what. And I'm sure everybody does. And I really appreciate it. One thing I want to say, so people watching, when Dave sent me his first book, it's been, I think it was probably November, and I despise reading on a tablet or my computer screen. And I literally did not put the fucking thing down as soon as you sent it to me, because I wrote you right after. I read the whole damn book. It's that good. And you don't even realize that I was sitting there like 45 minutes because I was so into it. The only other thing I get more enthralled in is reading the Bible when I read every day. So, like, it's that it was so informative and so well written, and you can tell there's no bias there. It's just strictly facts, because you can tell when you're reading a fucking book by a gosh damn politician, damn near, you know, when it's just bias. This is strict fact, and you gain so much from it. So, you know, he does lectures that are free. The books are not expensive. I would go check the books out so you have them and you can read them. I'm a guy that likes to read. I like to listen, but I like to read. But either way, I have talked to thousands upon thousands of people over my years. And I'm not saying this because you're on here that I need to kiss anybody's fucking ass. You're one of the smartest people I've ever talked to. So I can't say that enough. And when I endorse somebody, my credibility is everything to me. So I don't do it often. So A+ grade for people, advanced fundamental health. And then I'm going to put everything in the description, but I just want everybody to know that these books and this information is fucking priceless stuff that I use as a reference myself. So if that tells you anything, I don't know everything, but I know the right references to use.
Yeah, thanks, man. And as I said before, when we met at the Olympia, it means a lot to me that you give me that endorsement, because I remember watching your videos back when I started TRT. The other day on WhatsApp, we were talking about the video games we grew up with, and I wrote that TRT 101 book inspired by the instruction manuals that came with like the Nintendo 64 games. Yes. I played as a kid. It's like, this is the instruction manual that should come with your TRT, because I didn't write a book on why you should go on TRT. I wrote a book on, like, this is how you do it. And it's step by step. And that way it's there so that if you can't get a good practitioner, because that should be the goal, that
you can at least have an idea of what you need to do and what you should expect. But it also means that you can read that and go, okay, this is how I can vet a practitioner to be like, okay, do they know what they're talking about? I got it designed in a way that it's easy to read. It's written like an instruction manual. You can control effort and find the keywords. It's written as easily as possible. And I priced it as cheaply as possible with the intention of just basically getting it to as many people as possible. So I think it's like with the conversion, it'd be like 17, 18 bucks US for a book. So there's TRT 101, which is like my how to do testosterone. There's Beyond TRT, which is basically pregnenolone, DHEA, thyroid, HCG, and estrogen and fertility. So it's all those big like, and I wrote that book in terms of being like, once you get 6 months into TRT, what's all the bamboozling myths and shit that come up online that confuse people and take them down rabbit holes and they start to freak out and end up doing stuff that messes them up. So it's like a big myth busting book. So any questions on those topics is all covered. And then over the next few months, I'm going to be bringing out TRT 102, which is going to be, I just like things in threes. So I wrote a third book. Yeah. But basically that's going to be like a summary of all the three war and masculinity lectures. So a lot of it's about mindset. There's a big chapter on all like the philosophical stuff that comes with like, you know, what TRT means in terms of it being a foundation for you to be able to be a happy, healthy, masculine man and what I think that means. And then it's everything else that didn't fit into the first couple of books. So all the stuff that people charge like hundreds and thousands of dollars for like courses and stuff, I just put everything in that book. All my supplement stacks, all my recommendations for everything, it's all just written in there. So across those three books, it's kind of like there's everything I could possibly give to you in as cheap of a price and as easy a way to understand it as possible. So yeah, they're on advancedfundamentalhealth.com and yeah, you can pick them up from there.
Awesome, man. Well, like I said, it was absolute pleasure. I know we're going to do this again, so we'll probably do it again in a couple months. And I can't wait to see you again, too, when we are at the Olympia this year. So looking forward to it all. Thanks again, everybody. I hope that you like really listen to this closely, especially on the topics that could be considered controversial by some, just so you can see both sides to the stories and kind of, you know, judge it for yourself. I always say, we're not your dads. All we do is provide you information on what we know, and then you have to weigh risk versus reward and decide what's best for you. Nobody can tell you that but yourself, okay? You're only subject to God in my book, so do what you do. But, you know, like I said, Dave, I appreciate it. I'll put all your information in the description below, and I just really hope people really pay close attention to this and watch, which I'm sure they will. So.
Absolutely, man. Well, once again, thank you so much for having me. It's awesome to be back here, and I'm very much looking forward to doing this again, and always a pleasure to chat to you either online or offline.
Absolutely, brother. Absolutely. All right, everybody. Well, another episode in the books. I hope this was informative and helps everybody. Stay tuned for plenty more to come. Dylan Jamelli and David Lee signing off.